In Matthew Galloway's The Power That Flows Through Us at Te Patakatoi Adam Art Gallery, cartoons from the 1970s and 80s by Robert Brockie, Sid Scales, Gordon Mihinnick and Daryl Crimp are reproduced in a printed newspaper and enlarged as life-sized sculptures. This podcast episode is a recording of a panel discussion taking this historical era of cartooning as its starting point. Of influence and impact. Political cartooning in Aotearoa took place on the 14th of May 2024 amongst the immersive exhibition Infrastructure, Power, Politics and Imagination. Featuring Sharon Murdoch, the first woman political cartoonist in the Aotearoa mainstream media, Sam Orchard, assistant curator for the Cartoon and Comics Archive at the Alexander Turnbull Library, and Dylan Horrocks, cartoonist and program leader and communication design at Te Herenga Waka, Victoria University of Wellington. This lively conversation explores the past, present and future of political cartooning in Aotearoa.
Kia ora, my name's Dylan Horrocks and I'm a long-time cartoonist. This is like an AA meeting. long-time cartoonist and now also teaching down at the School of Design Innovation here at Victoria University. I'm really, really always excited to have a chance to sit down with Sharon and Sam, both of whom are extraordinary cartoonists. And Sam also is now the... I can never remember the official title. Assistant curator.
Cartoons and comics.
Cartoons and comics at the Alexander Turnbull Library, in which capacity Sam is fast becoming one of the all-time experts on cartoons and political cartoons in New Zealand. And Sharon, of course, has been cartooning for a long time.
Since 2013.
And was that when you started The Cats?
I started political cartooning in 2013.
And has been cartooning other characters, including Marvelous Cats, in the post for a long time. But also, I think it's really interesting having you part of this conversation because you were also involved in the Wellington Media Collective way back when that was an example of artists, designers and cartoonists getting together to produce art expressly with an activist agenda. One of the reasons I think it's worth bringing together political cartoonists for this as part of this exhibition series of events is that in Matthew Galloway's exhibition, the central theme really is power and how power flows through society in Aotearoa, using both the metaphor of the Clyde Dam, which harnesses natural forces to produce power for the society in the form of electricity, causing all sorts of damage along the way, but also this exhibition, and in particular, if anyone has not already looked at it, the newspaper included in this exhibition is a central part of the show. And in there, Matthew interviews a whole range of people who were involved in the political struggle over the construction of the Clyde Dam from all sorts of different directions. And he includes a number of political cartoons in there from the 1970s to the 1990s. And each of those cartoons is a kind of engagement with the way power was operating in the political landscape in New Zealand at the time. And so what I'd really like to kind of discuss with both of you is the role that political cartoons play in the workings of power in this country, sometimes trying to frustrate it or expose it or derail it, but also sometimes as part of the workings of power, how it also enforces it. So my first kind of question for you is, what role do you feel that political cartooning had at the time this exhibition covers? So this is 1970s to 1990s. It's 30 years ago now. And how it's changed since then. Sharon, do you want to?
Well, I suspect it was more powerful during that time because, you know, we're flooded with images now, and the political cartoon is just one of many, you know. But at that time, I think that the newspaper was a much more, you know, if something was in the newspaper and the cartoonists were known, and they did have a fair amount of clout, I think, across, like many cartoonists did, I think. But now it's probably more an acquired taste. you have people who really do enjoy them. It's it has the power to irritate and annoy. I know from the feedback I get that, you know, there is quite a number of people who, I suppose it is testament to them having some power and that people are so angered by them. But also you do get a lot of feedback is from people who feel that they've been seen. You know, that their experience has been seen, or their, and I think that in itself is probably, it gives a power to the viewer, you know, to the person taking in the political cartoon. Yeah. I know.
Just to follow up, do you feel, I mean, you've been doing political cartoons for the Dominion Post now for, as you say, about 11 years, I guess. Do you feel like the profession has changed in that time?
Yeah, well, probably during that time there was Tom Scott, who was that long tradition of cartooning and a particular style of cartooning. And with his... it's not his demise because he's still going strong, but, you know, there has been that, well, there's been a couple of women now who are cartooning regularly. And I don't know, I suppose it's the lesser known, you know, that they don't have this kind of, fame that say Tom Scott did. Because he was such a personality, you know, unto himself. He had a whole, he could tell stories and he was quite a raconteur. And, you know, so it was broader than just his cartoons.
Yeah, he was certainly, he was definitely a public figure.
Yeah.
Throughout the 70s and 80s.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Sam, I mean, at the archive, you've got a kind of overview of political cartooning in New Zealand going right back to the 1800s.
Yeah. I think the intention of political cartoons has stayed the same as a way of kind of reflecting back or undermining or provoking or solidifying political events. But I think the landscape within that has changed so dramatically within the last... I mean, the media landscape changes by the minute at the moment. Like, I think that newspapers played a really different role because they were produced regionally and daily, so they become a kind of full stop in some ways. And I feel like the political cartoons are really that full stop because they're picking the issue of the day and saying, this is my viewpoint on that. Whether it's kind of saying, yay, wonderful, or this is terrible, or isn't it all a bit silly, it's still kind of static in a way that now news cycles are just so rapid and fast, and we live in a culture with memes and people generating images and content all the time on the internet that it becomes something different. Like you say, you're kind of competing with a whole different landscape at the moment. So I think that changes quite a lot. And the fact that newspapers really supported their cartoonists. They were on the payroll. They shepherded in new cartoonists and had mentor programs that happened, so that, you know, Minhemmick got mentored by David Lowe, and that gets pushed through in a I'm making assumptions here, but I don't know that infrastructure and support still exists in newspapers today.
But certainly I wasn't mentored in that way. I worked at the newspaper as a designer, and I was doing some political illustration. And when Tom Scott was going on leave, he nominated to the newspaper two young male cartoonists, and I didn't get any kind of look in, even though I was saying I would really like to have a go at this.
I'm right here.
I'm like, please. And then another editor at the Waikato Times ran their cartoons for, I think, a week, and then he contacted me and said, I would rather run your cartoons. So kind of ironically, it was a man who helped me I did cartoons for them for about 3 weeks, and then the Post picked them up. But as far as that mentorship, I suppose that my mentorship was, I lived with Trace Hodson, who was a cartoonist in the 80s and 90s. And my mentorship was probably living with him, you know, and watching what he was doing and how he approached it. And at the time, he probably, his success and how good he was at it put me off. You know, because you thought, oh, I could never do that. Mm. I could never be as good as that or even approach that. So you'd dismiss it. Mm. Mm. Although he was very encouraging, you know.
I mean, I often think about how particular political eras for me, and maybe it's just because I'm obsessed, but for me, I often feel like particular eras are defined by particular cartoonists. Mm. Trace Hodgson was, for me, the person who defined the Fourth
he
Labor
really
government.
Was. Yeah.
Whereas Tom Scott, you know, was one of the people who defined the Muldoon era.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it's possible for a cartoonist to have that kind of, definitive role these days?
I wouldn't think so in the same way. I remember that whole coterie of men who, you'd get Brocky and Bromhead and Tom Scott and Trace and, I remember and a few people that kind of went under the radar, Bill Painter and, Chris Slane. And they were all really good, but I think it's an era that's ended, that kind of, and I'm not sure what this current one is.
We'll get to that. I do want to nominate Sharon as the cartoonist who defined the Jacinda Ardern era for me, actually, and particularly COVID. I think that COVID era, there were cartoons that you did during that era that to me will, they will be in the history books when people tell that story. Mm-hmm. Certainly the place of political cartooning in the media landscape has changed, but also the people doing it. And you've already alluded to that, Sharon, that you were one of the first, I'm hesitating to say the first, because that seems like an assumption.
In mainstream media, I think, like Rosemary McLeod, where she was cartooning more on social, more directly social issues rather than political.
Yeah, but it was a very male landscape, wasn't it? And what I want to ask both of you is how you think the fact of who it was that was doing this, the demographics of the group who were doing this, how do you think that shaped the issues that were addressed, the perspectives that were given, how those issues were defined during that period that this show covers.
I think it inevitably shaped it. I mean, you don't, pretty much all kind of straight white men, and it just by necessity, it had to be the lens through which they saw the world and what they thought was important, and like for me, I'm going to see I cartoon more often on issues that affect women, or it's certainly broader. Yeah, I was just saying before we started this session about a book festival in Christchurch that a few of us cartoonists spoke at, and Bromhead, who's in his 90s now, he was a cartoonist, a very good cartoonist, and there was Toby Morris and I can't remember who else was there, and there's a photo of on the screen behind us of one of my cartoons, which was a girl riding a sanitary pad like a magic carpet, and these tampons flying along beside her like pilot fish. And it was about, the liberating effect of access to sanitary products. Mm. And we were all kind of engaged, and Bromhead was asleep. I mean, it's sort of a literal take on that, but he was so asleep, he was nearly sliding off his chair. But I think to him it was kind of, he didn't understand that. And I have had things with him on Twitter. He responded to one of my cartoons, which was about a woman being assaulted walking home at night. And he said, "This isn't a cartoon." He responded, "This isn't a cartoon. This isn't kind of political. This is like," and of course it was a cartoon and it was political. And it was that notion of, to be a political cartoon, it had to be funny, which I don't think it does have to be. It has to be poignant or wry or kind of, there's any number of things it can be, but it doesn't have to be funny. And my husband replied to Bromhead, and I thought,
that's
bold. No. And I thought, why did you do that? And he said, and then it took Bromhead a couple of days, and Jeff's response to him, he had said, you might read it, you might learn something. And I thought, this is going to end really badly. But then a couple of days later, he said, yeah, maybe I might, and he left it at that.
Hmm. And possibly expanding the idea of, like, there might have been a very narrow idea there of what constituted a political issue as well.
Yeah, I think that is definitely right. He would, it would have to involve politicians.
I agree. Like, there's two levels of it. There's that curation of what's the most important topic, or the topic that the cartoonist wants to spend time and energy on. And then it's the viewpoint within that as well. There's a cartoon that you had done around the time that Winston Peters was kind of provocating about abortion reform.
Mm.
And it has, a woman who is kind of bent over looking shamed, and Shane Jones and Winston Peters kind of looking at her and making her justify whether she wants an abortion or not. And that same week, Jeff Bell had done a a cartoon about abortion reform as well, which was around kind of looking at abortion, the first level of abortion reform coming through many years ago. I'm not good with dates. And then Winston Peters kind of, and it had it as just showing it as a political issue, which is two different viewpoints of the same thing. And they're both really important commentaries, but Jeff is looking at it from a political issue and saying this is about legislation, and you're looking at it from like this impacts women, and it's just those two different viewpoints that you have that ultimately are informed by your subjectivity. Like, you've done a cartoon this week around Winston Peters and his
only cartoon about Winston Peters.
I mean, he's a prominent feature in the cartoons and comics archive. He's everywhere. He's been here for a very long time.
He's essentially a cartoon character.
Around trans access to toilets, and particularly targeting trans people.
Yeah.
Like, the cartoon that I would write about that as a trans person will be quite different to how you would write about it. Like, that's just how it is. And certainly that would be my focus of the week if I was an editorial cartoonist. I quite often will be like, what would I write this week if I had that job? Like, that would be the one that moves me the most. And I think that cartoonists get into this profession because we are, we have a lot of emotions, for better or worse. Like, we do things because we want to speak back to what is happening. And choosing what we speak to back to is a choice, and choosing how we speak back to that is a choice. If that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm very conscious that in the audience we have in fact Paul Diamond, whose extraordinary book Savage Deceit is a history of how Māori have been depicted in political cartoons in New Zealand, and mentions the very small number of Māori political cartoonists in New Zealand. Overwhelmingly, the history of political cartooning in New Zealand has been Pākehā cartoonists, but not entirely. Of course, Sharon, yourself, you whakapapa Māori as well. But yeah, do you have thoughts, either of you, about how that has shaped the perspectives of political cartooning in New Zealand? How political cartoonists are speaking to or for power in the context of Māori Pākehā relationships in New Zealand?
We've had some bad examples of it.
Yes.
Well, more than a few, but like I was thinking particularly of Al Nesbitt's cartoons that were very, I think, damaging, actually. I don't think they were just in poor taste. They were, they kind of validate or the views of some people. I don't know. I find it a really difficult. Should excuse me. I had a stroke during brain surgery a couple of years ago, and I have some aphasia. So if I lose my words, it's because of that. But I'll let you talk.
I think that the cartoon archive, as it exists, largely has white, cis, straight, middle-class, male perspectives on political issues. And, you know, sometimes that's really powerful receipts to say, like, when people say, oh, racism isn't that bad in this country, then you can look at the cartoons. They speak for themselves. And quite often they're like really powerful historical records that show what is acceptable and what is not. When I think about someone like Tom Scott, for example, who has been doing, you know, cartoons have a long career. Some of his jokes have been repeated, as you do, and they were acceptable in 1 year, and they are not acceptable in the next year. Like, and I think that's really interesting. What passes the test in terms of what gets published and what doesn't, and what society's appetite is for some of those viewpoints. But there's certainly like there's a missed opportunity there for some of the issues in the cartoons and comics archive. It only has one side of the story. And that's an important side of commenting on the racism that exists. But it doesn't, it also needs some rebalancing for people to speak back to that and what it's like to be part of a group that is being talked about without any agency to have that voice back.
Which brings me to another question I have, which is that cartoons exist, of course, outside of newspapers, and cartoons that are political exist outside newspapers, and that's always been the case. Mm-hmm. So during the period covered by this exhibition, you know, the 1970s to the 1990s, there were cartoons that were political elsewhere as well. Do you have thoughts about how those voices differed and what we see when we include them in the broader landscape of political cartooning?
I think a much more interesting range, because cartoonists who work for newspapers are quite limited in some ways what they'll publish, you know, and you have a fair idea what, you know, how they'll approach that. My personal experience is I've not had that many knockbacks with the cartoons that I've done, but I can't, because I work for the newspaper, I can't really reveal the things that are being knocked back. But what I would say is that if I were publishing or printing online, or, you know, I would have a great deal more freedom, you know, like, is it Daniel Vernon? Yeah. That he's able to say things in his cartoons that I couldn't really get away with, you know. But it's good, that mix, and especially now that those cartoons are so available, you know, that if you go looking for them, they're just available.
And you've been making a real effort, along with others at the Turnbull, to expand the remit of the Cartoon and Comics Archive to include some of that work that might have been left out before. What sort of things are you finding?
Yeah, so the cartoon, it was originally the Cartoon Archive. It was collecting specifically editorial cartoons in newspapers. When we think about what political cartoons can be, it's bigger than that. You know, when I think about the stuff that I've done, which is basically an autobio comic about my life, which is very silly, but now, I also happen to be a trans person, and therefore inherently, without necessarily me kind of saying I'm a political person, but because trans people become a punching bag is the only word I can use, a political kind of football, therefore my comics are political, even if they're just like a silly story about me doing a comic on what I ate for dinner, you know. So I think that's kind of important to kind of look in different places. But, you know, there's things like Broadsheet, which have always had political cartoons as part of them. They're just not part of mainstream media in the same way. There's zines that are full of political cartoons. There's people like Daniel Vernon who does Yeehaw the Boys, which is almost entirely on Instagram or social media or Substack, where he's telling longer form stories, not just single panel, but he's quite outrageous. Mm. And I think probably mainstream media would be a bit too scared to publish his stuff. But it's exciting and it's part of the landscape as well. And it's part of collecting all of those stories around what is happening within Aotearoa and our histories and how political decisions impact our lives.
And I think in the exhibition, and particularly in the newspaper, there is a discussion of not just the Clyde Dam, but also the proposed aluminium smelter that didn't get built in the end. And the activism against that included a long comic that was published at the time, which was about Comalco, and it was all about the corruption in the business. And comics like Moana Maniapoto drew a comic in the 1990s,
Kia Matara, which was made as part of a collective group, and they self-published a graphic novel basically that tells the colonial history of New Zealand and the impacts on Māori. It's amazing. And it was distributed via fax and mail through different marae and kohanga and schools.
Mm. So all these little, all these pockets that aren't necessarily represented by just the history of newspaper cartooning. Something else that came up when you were talking, Sharon, political cartoons have long thrived. I mean, really, they're built around caricature. So a lot of it is about taking a politician and turning them into a cartoon character. But other people are represented as caricatures as well, including just ordinary people who are used to stand in for groups and categories of people. And so there's a long history of stereotypes playing a part in cartooning as well. I guess what I'm interested in is political cartoonists have often liked to insist that it's an inherently subversive form that speaks back to power and fights for the powerless in the face of power. How much do you think that's true, both of you, that cartoons are inherently subversive?
I don't think inherently, but I think there's definite exceptions. But, well, I think that there's probably people who do cartoons and it is all about the caricature, you know. Mm. And so doing a good caricature and having a joke, that is all that's required of it. But if you want to do something more than that, and I think it probably needs some kind of social conscience or awareness or empathy for what's happening to people around you, then it will be, will be subversive or,
Do you, just as a side question, how do you develop a caricature of a politician? What's your method here?
Well, there's some people who I find particularly difficult to do a caricature of. David Seymour is one of them, because you'd think he would be really easy. Yeah, he's got the eyebrows that go up and he's got
the little curly.
Yeah, they got the little curled at the front and his eyes go up and he's got the kind of, mouth that does a nearly comic thing. And he should be easy, but I find him extraordinarily difficult. And I wonder if it's because my feeling about him is so strong. Mm. You know, that I can't distance myself from him, So, and he's also attacked me a sort of few times. So that might make it more difficult as well.
Who's really easy?
Well, I suppose Judith Collins. I just when she was in the
she's
new,
fun to draw.
Yeah, she is so much fun to draw because she's like a character from Shakespeare or something, you know. And she's got her eyebrows that are nearly
so good.
Off her face, and she was like, I suspect that she's stopped doing a few things to I don't know. And also because, I mean, that she's a woman that's probably not too far from my own age. And so I there's kind of this odd affection at the same time as there's just like this horror. And so you have quite a good time with her. Like, he was really hard to draw, and I think that cartoonists dealt with them after a while of they would look to each other like, you know, how's this person drawing Key? And gradually everybody would pick up this way of drawing him, and then the public would say, oh, that's Key. You know, they'd know that was Key because he fitted into these like I remember Tom Scott saying about Key that he had a face like a knife stabbed through a scrotum. which is sort of like odd because, in fact, he didn't have a knife-like nose, let alone his cheeks, but, you know, it was...
And that became controversial. Like, as you say, this consensus caricature developed.
Yeah.
And it did include a very prominent nose.
And then
that became controversial.
Yeah, because it did, because of the anti-Semitic thing. Mm. And I think that probably a lot of people, a number of cartoonists, when they first started drawing Key, were unaware of his Jewishness.
Mm.
And so it's hard to say. I mean, that whole thing that blew up with Steve Bell in the UK, he did a cartoon of Netanyahu. And, in fact, Netanyahu, his facial features, he didn't do anything with his face. It was played into those kind of tropes. But what he did do was he had him with a bared chest, and he's cutting a piece of flesh out of his stomach in the shape of Gaza. And of course, that was the pound of flesh. I don't think he even said the pound of flesh on the cartoon, but it was the pound of flesh. And that was Shylock and Jewish character, you know, and he got fired over it. And I think I wonder if the reason he got fired over it was because he revealed the Guardian's unhappiness with that cartoon, and then he put it up online himself and said that they were unhappy with it. Whereas around the same time, Martin Rawson, who's another British cartoonist, and the British cartoonists have this, I wonder if our tameness in our cartooning, particularly in newspapers, kind of goes back to that colonial, you know, we're nice, we don't do anything to... And the British were doing these cartoons that were, like, outrageous. They were kind of... Their characters all have big rubbery lips and, you know, grotesque, and they're quite often naked.
Yeah, it's all underpants and bottoms.
Yeah. It is all underpants and bottoms. And we don't do that.
And the Australian Australian scene is pretty full on too.
Yeah.
Really ruthless.
Yeah. I could guarantee that I would not get a cartoon like that published here.
It's interesting. My colleagues from America and Europe often comment on how Pākehā New Zealanders are so passive aggressive. And I didn't think about that until they said it. And I thought, we're not passive.
Yeah.
Oh, no, we actually are. We're really. We're, you know, people ask us to do something, and we say, oh, that's an interesting idea. It's, yeah, maybe. And the whole time we're thinking, that is just such a stupid idea. There's no fucking way. Yeah, no, it's, yeah. So, but I guess I hadn't thought about how that shapes our cartooning tradition as well. Do you see that?
The passive aggressiveness.
And, but also the reluctance to be as out there and in on the surface.
Yeah, and I mean, that makes sense to me as, you know, I think there's a kind of Kiwi mentality of like, oh, we're just a silly little nation, you know, don't take us too seriously. Like, you look at the Muldoon depiction downstairs with bullet holes, and he looks like a lovable guy. Mm. He's kind of a sweetheart. Like, that's a really interesting depiction of Muldoon. And there's a lot of depictions of Muldoon in the cartoon archive that are like that, where he's a kind of sweet-looking guy. There's a lot of real nasty ones as well.
Yeah.
But there's... But
somehow we were allowed to do that with Muldoon.
Yeah. And I think it's... I suspect that it's kind of the Judith Collins thing where... These people who are intentionally shaping themselves visually with those markers to say, I am this political icon, therefore they can be have those icons made of themselves, whereas there's a New Zealand style of politician that's like, oh, I'm just like your dad, the John Key kind of thing, I'm just a regular guy kind of thing, which doesn't lend itself as well to cultural lambasting.
I mean, famously, Winston Churchill chose to always be seen with the cigar and the Bomberg and so on because that was his iconic look, and it made him into a political icon, as you say. And
a gift to cartoonists, because then you can just put in those symbols that are, because you need to get a lot of information across in quite a small space. Mm. So having those things that you can just draw, that you can refer to, so people can quickly understand, oh yeah, that's who that is.
And Sharon, do you feel like that becomes an overly symbiotic relationship? Like, are there times when you feel like your cartoons are helping the people that you're trying to call into question by turning them into an icon or giving them publicity?
I'd hope not. I don't know. It's
I shouldn't have brought it up. Don't question what you're doing. It's fine.
I'll move on to you at the moment.
I mean, coming back to your question around whether cartoons or comics are subversive or not, I think I would say that cartoons and comics are powerful, and I'm interpreting subversive meaning to undermine power. And I don't think that that's always the intention.
Mm.
There's lots of different intentions of why people do cartoons. Sometimes it is to undermine power through making people look silly or incongruous or just kind of showing them back to themselves in their mean-spiritedness. I think there's a lot of times that people are kind of like with Muldoon, it's a political decision to draw him as a kind of happy-looking character.
Mm.
And I think that has an impact on how they're viewed by the reader. If you draw him as a literal toad, which I think that's in there, I think there's a Rocky one in there that has Muldoon as a toad, then that says something in and of itself, regardless of what the cartoon is.
Frogs and toads make quite a few appearances, actually, in these. It's obviously a thing. I kind of want to hand over to people in the audience, but I just have one last question about that, which is that, you know, it feels a little like we're moving into a political era at the moment where simply being seen as powerful becomes an appealing thing for many people.
Mm.
And so showing you know, Muldoon was also shown as kind of dictatorial. I remember in the 1980s, there was a lot of cartoons of Margaret Thatcher, Muldoon, and so on, both showing them as these kind of dictators. And at times it felt like they thrived on that. And now we have figures like Trump and possibly a few people here in New Zealand as well, yes, who would like to be seen as having this masculine kind of, you know, force and power. Mm. Is there like that must be quite hard to wrestle with? Like, how do you satirize people like that in a way that when they thrive on just being a meme, essentially?
Mm. I was thinking that there was there's this thing, I don't know if you've heard of it, called Godwin's Law, that this comes from the internet, that at a certain point of an argument's gone on long enough, someone says someone else is compares them to Hitler, or says they are Hitler, or they make some kind of Nazi parallel. I did that with
David Seymour.
David Seymour. I didn't even I didn't even have the long argument. I just went straight to that. I was so incensed by that stage. and the cartoon was I wasn't saying that he was Hitler or that he was a Nazi. But what he was talking about was free speech and hate speech. And
is this the one with Hitler on one side and a person
from the Klux Klan?
Yeah, and they're both giving David Seymour a little
kiss on the cheek. They're both kissing him on the cheek, and he's saying, "Oh, I know, I can trust you not to go too far." You know, and I thought, and at that time, David Seymour was talking about getting rid of the Human Rights Commission. And I don't know, his whole rhetoric was so ugly and continues to be so ugly. And it's cunning as well, the way he goes about it. He somehow manages to, you know, it's like having a meeting with your boss. And while you're in the meeting and you're thinking, "Oh, that's reasonable. You know, that's reasonable." And then you get out of the meeting and you're thinking, this is just completely unreasonable, you know. And that's what I feel about him. But anyhow, he wanted to get rid of the Human Rights Commission. But the irony of this was that somebody who liked him a lot, radio presenter from Canterbury, took me to the Human Rights Commission. And they lodged a complaint, and what was his name? Feng Moon? What? Sorry, I'm having a moment.
Meng Fu.
Meng Fu. He kind of found in his favour and said that this use of this trope was totally inappropriate at any time. And kind of, but this was all, you know, and David Seymour's on the radio and he said that I was low rent and that, you know, kind of, and low paid. I don't know how he'd know how much I was paid, but it seemed important to him that I was low paid.
I'm sure you're not paid enough.
Maybe he was making a comment about pay equity for women. Yeah.
It's nice that David Seymour is prepared to stand up for political cartoonists in New Zealand.
And yeah, the whole thing was so...
Well, the whole thing is drenched in irony, and irony feels like it's such a big part of a strategic toolkit now for people in politics, particularly on the right, almost an aggressively, provocatively ironic approach to things. And both of you have mentioned memes in this conversation as well. Like, is that where that is all happening now, or and on social media?
We spend a lot of time on our phones and in front of screens, and I think that that's sucking a lot of that energy. But you look around some of the streets of Wellington, there's a big Ona Te Tiriti poster campaign that's happening, that on official, you know, phantom billboards. There's also a lot of political cartoons that are taped to street poles still. Mm. Like people, what I love about cartoons and comics is that visual, that combination of words and pictures together is really powerful, and it's something that human beings are drawn to, and we'll go to it online and we'll go to it in real life. And I think that, you know, I think as a society, we're grappling with how much time we spend online and how much, I'm a public service, I'm politically neutral, but how much we are willing to give away to corporations. And there's a tension there that I think we're grappling with constantly. But I still think that there's a lot of power in art on paper that's being put up on streets, and that's still happening, and it will always happen. Art in books will always happen. In galleries will always happen. That's not going anywhere. There's a slightly different shift in focus at the moment, but I think that the power of cartoons still exists and still will always exist.
And Sharon, you do share your cartoons on social media, and I imagine that's where a lot of people see them and engage with them.
I think that's where people, where they use cartoons, you know, like people use them to say, this is how I feel about this thing. And its potency is, you know, the reproducing of it. And so although, you know, you might think it's just in the newspaper, it is online. And I think that probably one of the things people in power hate about them is they are so immediate, you know, that they're immediate. They don't take, you know, there's a lot of things, there's a lot of topics I feel that you can't approach in a political cartoon because they're too complex, or, you know, to approach them, you have to say, there's this and there's this, or this is moderated by something over here, or, you know. But with the subjects that you can make a blunt and statement about in a drawing, they are so potent. You know, they're like an image that stays with you. So, and that way they can have a very long life. Hmm.
And I think they can stick in your mind as well. Yeah. There's every day there's people, researchers who come to the library and they're wanting to find a cartoon that they read 30 years ago that maybe had Winston Peters on a motorbike and he was talking about gangs or something. Winston
Peters, that was Trace Hudson.
But, you know, that I think that's true, that power just stays with you, and people want to use those to say, this was a moment in time and I want to revisit that.
Right, yeah.
Of all the things going on around the world and all the things happening locally, and you can just feel like the world is so terrible. And it, but then I suppose the thing of doing a political cartoon, you're quite privileged as well in that you can express your frustration or your anger, or you, and actually probably the cartoons that you're angriest about don't appear angry, you know, but underneath a lot of them I think it is anger, you know.
And Sam, you've expressed that political fatigue at times in your own cartoons as well.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I'm politically neutral.
You keep saying it.
Neutral and occasionally a little fatigued.
Yeah. I do think that political cartoonists must be having a really hard time at the moment because there's just so much going on all the time, because the news cycle is so fast, and because we're living in a really complicated time. I'm really interested in, I was in some of the stuff that got shared around COVID in particular, where you'd have these groups who would use words like freedom and twist them in a really different way, which when you have a limited time and space, like, how do you signal that stuff without saying it to this group which you're trying to actually undermine or subvert? It just must be, you know, I'm not clever enough for that. It just seems really hard. Which I guess is what you're saying around, like, there's just some issues that you can't do at the moment.
Yeah, I definitely think there are some, you know. I was looking at some of the memes online about Gaza, and I thought that, like, what is happening there is so horrific. And yet, you know, these people are putting, like, that's what I might feel when I think of this. Like, I was looking at this meme and it had this Netanyahu with holding these bloodied babies, and they look like they'd been ripped apart. You know, there was something about that Kronos kind of eating children and stuff. And then you realize, and I've done some cartoons on that, and people have said, you know, where's your condemnation? Like, it's like this thing of condemnation. Like, where's your condemnation of what Hamas did? Or where's your, you know, and you sort of, you get into this. You can't say all that in a cartoon. You know, you can't say, you can't cover all the history before that. So it's kind of taking this one moment in time, and you, feels like you have to take great care with how you do that. Like, it isn't just about making a joke or and in that way it can be dangerous, I think, you know. It's like,
so cartoons are very powerful, and with great power comes great responsibility.
I may never do one again.
I really shouldn't have said anything. So I just want to really thank the Adam Art Gallery for this event and for all the conversations this exhibition is going to be generating. And I really want to thank you all for coming tonight, and also enormously thank Sharon and Sam for all of their wisdom tonight. Thank you both.
Thank you.